Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. For those of you who might not be so familiar with this tradition and our customary ways of doing things, that the little verse that Kelly is reciting there very well is a verse that whenever we're giving some kind of formal Dhamma talk is recited in this particular tradition. Also in the northern Buddhist tradition, particularly in China, they use a very, very similar way of requesting a Dhamma talk. And so it recounts a time just after the Buddha's enlightenment where he's pondering the truth that he's awoken to, the insight that he's realized under the Bodhi tree, and over the weeks following that time, investigating, exploring the nature of reality that he's awoken to, that he's realized. And his feeling at that time is, this is just way too difficult to try and explain to anybody. This is so subtle, this is so profound, this goes so heavily against the grain for ordinary human beings. There's absolutely no point in me trying to explain this to anyone. No one's ever going to get it. So maybe I'll just live a quiet life and just carry on as a freelance yogi and not bother trying to convey this to anybody. So then the Brahma deity Sahampati then picks up this thought, shimmering through the ether and up in the Brahma worlds, and the Brahma Sahampati then is moved by this urgency of concern. Oh no, the newly awakened Buddha, after all these lifetimes of preparation and development of the spiritual qualities, now the newly awakened Buddha is inclined towards inaction, towards not teaching. The world will be lost. The world will be utterly lost, is the phrase. And so then Sahampati disappears from the Brahma world and boop, manifests in front of the Buddha, and then makes this request. Please, for the sake of those with just a little dust in their eyes, please share what understanding you have. It's true that many beings are completely enmeshed in greed, hatred and delusion, but there are some with only it's a little bit of dust clouding their eyes. And then the Buddha apparently cast his vision around the world and assessed the situation again and thought, well, maybe Sahampati's right. And so then he agreed to teach. And so we are the recipients of the Brahma Sahampati's initiative, so thank you very much for that. And so this is a way that Dhamma teachings are requested, and then they're given in response to that request. This is a very beautiful and significant principle, also because it lies behind the whole style of teaching, and the style of this Buddhist relationship within the Buddhist world, of certainly the monastic order and the greater community, that we don't go around knocking on doors or stopping people on the streets or belaboring people with our newfound insight. But it's more responding to invitation. There's a request, there's an invitation, And then there's a response. If there's no invitation, if there's no request, then we just take our ease and abide peacefully by ourselves. So that's why we're not a missionizing order. We're not a proselytizing order. It's like a strong tradition of waiting until there's the interest or the initiative coming from the hearts of individuals, and then responding to that. So this is a principle not just that relates to the teaching Dhamma or the presence of Buddhism in the greater world, but also it relates to our own practice, our own meditation. And that in a way it reflects that sense of not just wading into our own minds and bodies and demanding that they be like this and don't be like that, and you should sit this way and you should think like that and don't think like this, and I know what's good for you. It's like going up and knocking on people's doors or stopping them on the street. I know what's good for you. I can see you look like the kind of person that really needs this. And sometimes we come at our own minds and our own bodies, our own lives, with this well-meant idealism of how we should be, how our nature should be, our character should be. And just as when somebody comes at us with that glint in their eye or comes knocking at our door, what happens? We even have Jehovah's Witnesses coming to Abhayagiri Monastery, actually. They used to come and try to get the novices interested in being saved, and eventually we asked them to stop coming around. But that's what happens to me when one sees the Jehovah's Witnesses. Not that I've got anything against them in particular, but that kind of glint in the eye, that missionary zeal, that there's a certain closing of the heart that tends to happen. There's a shutting down. And so oftentimes when we try to work with our own mind, our own feelings, what we're experiencing or in the body, or this having already got a fixed model of how we should be, how we should feel, what states should be arising, and what we should think and what we should not think, we get the ideal firmly fixed in place, and then we try to and we compare the actuality of what we experience with that, and we try to force the actuality into the model of our ideal, and all we get is grief, struggle and difficulty, because the felt and experienced me is very, very rarely anything remotely like the ideal me. In the Greek myth of Procrustes, the Procrustean bed. Procrustes was this character who had a little bed and breakfast, like in sort of the Greek mythological world. And anybody who went to stay at Procrustes' house, he guaranteed that this bed would fit everybody who came to stay there. And he thought, oh, what a miraculous bed! It's always the right size. But then, What the guests found out after they came to stay there was it was the right size, because if you were very tall, you would chop a bit off, kind of trim your feet off, a bit of your lower leg, or if you were a bit short, then you would kind of get stretched out. So this is what's called the Procrustean bed. Is what we often do to our minds. We're kind of trying to make ourselves, stretching ourselves out, making ourselves trying to be more peaceful and loving and kind, or trying to be less restless and angry and fearful, stretching things out and chopping bits off, because of an ideal that we have. So in these, I like to emphasize within these first few days of a retreat, not taking this Procrustean method of mental development, stretching things out and chopping bits off, because all you get is grief and misery and a lot of blood all over the floor and howls of anguish. And to instead have a much more accommodating attitude, just to be cultivating a profound and definite quality of loving kindness and acceptance of the way things are. So oftentimes the loving kindness, metta bhavana, is represented as a sort of individual and separate kind of practice, like concentration meditation, samatha practice or insight practice, vipassana, and then metta bhavana, loving kindness meditation, and that's the most common way that it's represented. But you know, from my own experience and the way I like to work with it and to encourage others to also to work with it, is seeing that really it's actually impossible to generate any kind of real concentration, any kind of real tranquility, or any genuine insight without there being a basis of loving kindness in our attitude. So it's more like a basic attitude, a pervasive attitude that needs to be in place in order for the other efforts and other kinds of practice to work effectively. So what I mean by loving kindness in this respect is, as we've alluded to a little bit during today, just that welcoming attitude, so that if there's some dullness or agitation or just distracted thoughts and memories and planning, ruminating, remembering old movies we've seen or favorite tunes or least favorite tunes that still won't go away, whatever they might be. Endless reruns of Rodgers and Hammerstein's musicals. Goats and ducks and geese better scurry. Where are they? Shut up! Go. I hate Oklahoma, go away. There's a bright golden haze on the meadow. Shut up! Yeah, sometimes that's the way it is. It's just out of nowhere these things are sort of pop up, or stray memories of people that we were at kindergarten with, or trying to remember that person who was sitting next to you at the last retreat, or a retreat you were at 5 years ago. How many retreats have I done at Angela Center? Now, let's think. Where did it begin? Yeah, the endless things that the mind wanders after is natural for this kind of qualities to be experienced, and aches and pains in the body, feelings of boredom and restlessness, working with the routine and the silence and so forth. So loving kindness in this respect is that all accommodating, welcoming attitude. That, we're not saying whether we like it or don't like it, whether it should be this way or it shouldn't be this way. We're sort of dismantling Procrustes' method of trying to force ourselves into some sort of mode, but just recognizing it's like this. Right now there's just this strange memory, or there's this ache in my back, or there's this feeling of frustration and boredom with the walking meditation, or the listening to the traffic noise. Right now it's like this. There's this is what's happening. So it's a radical acceptance. It's like a basic acceptance. Well, good or bad, right or wrong, pleasant or painful or neutral, here it is. This is what the world is like at this moment. So when we have established that, not just as an idea, but as a felt sense in the heart of recognizing it truly all belongs, everything that we experience internal and external, it's all part of nature. How could it not be? Even if it's ugly and painful or profane or chaotic or indescribable to some sort of weird unusual feeling or perception that there isn't a name for. Whatever it might be, even if there's no name for it, it's still part of nature, still part of the way things are. How could it not be? So that in this respect, loving kindness is that recognition in the heart that it all belongs There's nothing that we experience, that we perceive or feel, that doesn't belong. Then, on the basis of that acceptance, that welcoming, that recognition, then we can discern and apply discriminative wisdom as to what's going to be of benefit to us and what's going to be harmful. You know, which is the states of mind and attitudes that are going to bring peace and clarity, that are going to bring comfort for ourselves, and which are the ones that are going to bring more chaos and pain and conflict. I always like to stress this basic chemistry of things at the beginning of a retreat, because it's so easy for us to come at our meditation from an idealistic position. We create the model of how I want to be, the perfect yogi, the ideal monk, the perfect nun, the diligent meditator, the one who's always getting it right, who sits perfectly still with a body free from pain, the attention focused, pinpointed on the present moment, delighting in the flow of the breath, occasional blazing insights, not too disturbing, just sort of colourful and bright, just sort of ballooning up every so often, just to sort of keep everything interesting, and utterly at peace and at one with all things. That's the ideal me. And then we have this sort of struggling, fretting, gnashing, complaining, griping, fearful, alienated, doubt-filled, miserable. Other me. Or variety of other me's, you know. And so we end up like sort of Procrustean bed, you know. It's just kind of misery and pain and frustration. But it's not as though with what I'm describing as loving kindness that we're approving of sort of doubts and fears and aversion and frustration and so forth, or saying, oh good, how marvelous, I'm seething with anger all day long, that's great. I'm utterly bored and restless, hooray. That's the idea. We're not pretending that the bitter is sweet, or the beautiful is what we're seeing when it feels ugly and painful. But we're recognizing it belongs. This is part of the whole picture. That in nature there is cruelty and pain as well as pleasantness and kindness and beauty. It's all part of the picture. Then on that basis of belonging, seeing every single thing belongs, then we can allow the discriminative wisdom to respond to that. Just like the Dhamma talk arising in response to the invitation, then our discrimination of what's skillful and wholesome, what's going to be beneficial, arises in response to that quality of welcoming, and that presence of awareness, of wisdom. That's what is the guide, that's what tells us, that's what rouses the intuition of, oh, this is a wholesome direction, this is a painful direction. Now, oftentimes when we, again, of the force of habit, is when we are not seeing clearly, when there's ignorance, then we, in response to the way things are, then the habit is to drift to either of two extremes. Yeah. We rather like Hamlet in his famous soliloquy, to be or not to be, that is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them. Which, translated into more comprehensible English, there are probably a few of you have had to learn this in your English high school classes, and maybe some of you have even recited it on stage. if not in your bathtub or other places. To be or not to be, that is the question. Is it nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, just to sort of succumb and just sort of give in, cave in, and just let it happen, and just get passive in response to the way things are, just sort of switch off and go numb and just let it all happen, and not do anything about it, so drifting towards a kind of nihilism or numbness, capitulation, succumbing, surrender in a sort of in a giving up kind of way, or to take arms against the sea of troubles in response to the way things are, then trying to change them and to you know, oppose the way things are and make them how we want them to be. So this represents very accurately in some ways the sort of two extremes of that we can easily follow in relationship to how the way things are. Either contending against them, trying to make them, you know, fit how we desire, or just giving up, or just becoming passive and switching off. In Pali, the Buddha defined these two kind of attitudes in his definition of tanha, of craving, the cause of suffering, of dukkha, of discontent. Vibhava tanha is the desire to get rid of, is that kind of nihilistic or annihilationist attitude which just switches off, or doesn't want to feel, doesn't want to know, just wants to push things away, wants to get numb, getting through life through just insensitivity, just not feeling. That reduces the pain, certainly. This is why we drink or you know, take drugs or get ourselves distracted, you know, in so many different ways, just so that we can avoid feeling. Then the other is bhava tanha, the desire to become, is like contending against the way things are, and starting a struggle against the way the mind is, against the way the body is, against the way the world is, where our roommate is, you know, the way the environment is, just in subtle and coarse kinds of conflict. And so it's these very qualities, you know, that the Buddha pointed to. The more we follow those habits of bhava tanha vibhava tanha, the desire to get rid of, the desire to annihilate, to switch off, or the desire to become, to get something, to become something. That we are always off balance, we're always out of harmony. The other cause of dukkha, the other cause of discontent, and the one that gets most press is karma tanha, which means sense desire, and that's the one that we usually relate to as being in the second noble truth, as the cause of dukkha, the origin of dukkha. When we think of desire, we tend to think of it in terms of desiring some pleasant experience, some kind of delightful sense object, or some thing that is compelling and pleasant, and we want to get hold of. But in meditation and mental development, bhavana, it's where karma tanha is kind of obvious. It's a sort of, yeah, I want some. Yes, nice, good, want, gimme. It's sort of easy to spot. It's sort of highlighted. With a little it's got a nice sort of luminous frame around it with neon lights flashing and kind of underlined three times in red. You know, desire, one. So it's kind of, even though it's a deep enough issue and problematic enough, it's these other more subtle relatives, the quiet cousins of karma tanha, that cause the most trouble in meditation. The desire to get rid of, or to annihilate, the desire to become, to be something, because they disguise themselves as in terms of useful and wholesome qualities, don't they? the desire to get rid of my restlessness, to get rid of my erratic thoughts, desire to get rid of my feelings of anger or jealousy or fear, the desire to become concentrated, the desire to become wise, the desire to become peaceful. Well, sounds like good stuff, doesn't it? I mean, isn't this what we're supposed to be doing? But this is one of the ironic and painful things about Dhamma practice, is that we can feel like we're following the formula and doing all the right things. I've got to get concentrated, I've got to get enlightened, I've got to get rid of my problems, I've got to get rid of my stupid thoughts and my obsessive memories, get rid of my unruly emotions, and then I'll be happy. But what we're missing is the fact that and why these are the cause of dukkha, is that these are all coming from coarser or subtle kinds of self. I want to get rid of, I need to become, I've got to get away from, I've got to get. And it slips by because it all seems so reasonable and good. You know, we can listen to the instructions, or we read the books, and we don't notice the I, me, my agenda slipping in and taking over. So this is another aspect of the practice that I really like to emphasize at the beginning of a retreat. First of all, the quality of loving kindness is the basis. And then when we're trying to apply effort, really establishing and knowing, getting a genuine, direct and felt sense for what right effort is, and how to distinguish between right effort and bhavatanna vibhavatanna, the desire to become, the desire to get rid of. Because even though those two look like, you know, the appropriate ways of working with the mind, all of us have experienced how, you know, when you try to get concentrated, you try to get rid of your chattering thoughts, but it can be really deeply frustrating and really annoying that, you know, the harder we seem to try to do the right thing, you know, the more conflicted, afflicted and difficult it all gets. When the Buddha defined right effort, he divided it into four chunks. So this is, I would suggest this is a, even though I don't want to make a whole kind of list, you know, a list fiesta. The Buddha was a great list maker. He was born in the spring in May, so he was probably under the sign of Taurus, but I'm sure he had a large slice of Virgo in there, because he's a tremendous, and speaking as a Virgo, I do love my lists. Nothing like a good list to bring a profound sense of contentment and happiness in life. The universe is in order, at least got everything lined up and pegged out. So this is one of the shorter of the Buddha's lists, and has four parts. So that right effort is divided into the restraining the unwholesome from arising, or if the unwholesome has already arisen, then to let go. So recognizing the unwholesome, restraining the unwholesome from arising. So like taking the precepts last night and establishing the intention to not kill each other or to steal. No matter how loudly your roommate is snoring, when they, where you are assured that you are not with the snorer, or how indignant you might feel at being told that you are a snorer when you know that you're not. What do you mean? You can hear me snoring through the wall. We take the precept to not kill or physically harm each other, to not take other people's belongings and so forth. So restraining the unwholesome from arising, or if it has arisen, then to let go, to release, to relinquish. Then the third one is cultivation of the wholesome, bringing the wholesome into being, so that the effort to sitting and walking meditation, the effort to cultivate loving kindness, the effort to focus the mind on the breathing, such like effort to arouse the wholesome, cultivation, bhavana. And then the last one, the fourth aspect of right effort is maintaining in being, anurakana, the holding in being, sustaining in being the wholesome that has arisen. So these aspects of right effort, then they look really like those kinds of desire, the desire to become, the desire to get rid of. You know, you can say, well, how do you tell the difference? What's the difference between the desire to become and, you know, this cultivation of the wholesome and maintaining the wholesome in being? What's the difference between the desire to get rid of and restraining the unwholesome and letting go of the unwholesome that's arisen? How do you tell the difference? Well, this is why we meditate. This is why we spend all these hours practicing, is to learn the difference between the voice of Mara and the voice of the Buddha, the voice of wisdom and the voice of delusion. When the motivation is colored with the I can't stand, I want, and when it's coming from a selfless place, when it's just the response of wisdom and mindfulness, kindness to the way things are, rather than me following a program, me wanting to get this, me wanting to get rid of that. The right effort is always free from the clouding by the I and me and my feelings. The tone and the quality of it is thus very, very different than when the motivation is coming from a self-centered view. But it's as T.S. Eliot says, it's like the live and the dead nettle, you know, beside each other, standing beside each other in the hedgerow. They look like each other. The leaves of the live nettle and the stinging nettle, and the leaves of the dead nettle, which doesn't sting. They look very, very similar. Or maybe that's a bit of an English example. Maybe a better in this neck of the woods is poison oak and and real oak, you know, real deciduous oak leaves. The leaves of the poison oak and the leaves of regular oaks, they look really similar. Yeah, they are identical. But when you attend closely, you see, oh, this one's growing on a vine, and it's got that particular, very distinctive curve to the twigs that we certainly in Abhayagiri we've come to know and respect, if not love. That very distinctive kind of arc to the sprigs that, you know, be cautious. But the leaves, they look the same shape, even the same colors. They have that reddish hue as they start to die off, even. So that they look very similar, but one carries a nasty itching rash for a couple of weeks, and the other is just the benign and lovely leaf of the fine oak tree, so it doesn't sting or harm. So it's really just experience and practice that, and feeling it out, getting to know it, is the way that we learn. This quality of attending, of listening to our own heart, listening to our own attitudes, getting a feel for it, of how effort is applied from a selfless place, where it's not just coming from me trying to do something, me trying to follow the instructions. You know, I'm trying to be a good yogi. I'm trying to do what I'm being told. I'm trying to get it right. And so listening to that, feeling that out, and getting to see the difference between me trying to get it right and then just trying to get it right. There's a difference in tone. One is there's application and effort in both respects. One, though, has got a cramped and limited quality to it. The other is free and open. But it takes a lot of time and attention and watching closely, feeling it out, to get to know the difference. But the effect and the result is of both tracks is vastly contrasting. You know, whereas when we're guided by the desire to get rid of, the desire to become, they're always going to be the results of our efforts are always going to have a kind of alienated and disconnected quality to them. There's always going to be an element of dukkha, of limitation, of restriction. Whereas when there is right effort, when we apply right effort, then there's always a liberating quality, a spacious quality. There's a clarity there. So what right effort is essentially is rather than just drifting towards switching off and succumbing to the way things are, or the desire to become, contending against the way things are, it's working with the way things are. And what we notice is that when we come across Buddhist teachings, often it talks about in being free from desire, and we can interpret that as a kind of passivity of like just leaving things alone, don't interfere. You know, everything is perfect just as it is. But as Suzuki Roshi once famously said, everything is absolutely perfect just as it is. But there's always room for improvement. So that's an extremely wise utterance. So what we find is that when we really open the heart to the way things are in this moment, and we see, oh, here's an agitated mind state, here's the mind remembering an old show tune, or here's the mind wanting to plan what I'm going to do after the retreat's over. Okay, this is just a stray thought. This is not a useful thing to be following. So then, rather than, I shouldn't be thinking this, I've got to get back to the breath, just letting the heart notice, oh, this is a distracted thought. And then trusting in the power of wisdom and awareness, like holding that distracted thought without me trying to do anything with it, just like getting the wisdom lamps on, lighting up the space with the light of wisdom and awareness. And another way I like to depict this or imagine this is, it's like as if the Buddha walks into the room, you know, turning the lights up, or the Buddha walks into the room. And then what happens to the mind grasping a distracted thought or playing with a memory or an irritation? And the Buddha walks in. It's like the cops show up. Oh, good morning, Your Honor. Your officer. Yes, sir. Yes. Whatever we're hanging on to, we suddenly find we feel very uncomfortable hanging on to it. We feel that sense of, oh, right, what am I doing? What was I getting caught up in? What was I trying to get away with? What was I playing with? What was I stuck into? Something wakes up. Something illuminates that entanglement, the mind stuck into some activity, some distracted realm. And it's not like, you know, the Buddha shows up and he's ready to scold us. Using an image of a policeman or a judge showing up is not that helpful. But more just like the gentle presence of the Buddha, when the mind is stuck on a distracted thought or a plan or a memory or a fantasy or drawn into a dull and numb state, the Buddha walks into the room, comes into the space. And then something in the heart is catalyzed. It says, oh yeah, right. And we don't even need to think those words. It's just like that the power of that presence of wisdom and awareness, we feel the cramped quality of attachment, of clinging, of being caught up. We feel the heaviness of the mind caught in a dull state. We feel the irrationality of being caught in a memory of something that happened 10 years ago that didn't even happen the way that we're we're re-scripting it. And that presence of wisdom, it lights up the situation. It illuminates that the cramped quality of clinging and entanglement. This is what then, it's like it's revealing the unwholesome that's been brought into being. So it catalyzes the quality of letting go. So it's not like when right effort is being practiced, it's not like, oh, I'm clinging, I should let go, because then that becomes kind of drifts towards the desire to get rid of. It's much more like allowing the wisdom to illuminate the picture, letting that full awareness know the discomfort of clinging, of being caught up, and then in the recognition of that discomfort, the painfulness of clinging, the cramped and limiting quality of clinging, then you know the heart lets go on its own. It's not me letting go. It's the natural effect of wisdom, of mindfulness, of kindness. Or something in the heart says, why do I want to do this to myself? This is pretty miserable. What is it that wants to hang on to this resentment or this plan or this gripe or this fantasy or this memory? And it doesn't even need, we don't even need to articulate it in words. We just, if you feel it, then the effect of that presence of wisdom, the Buddha entering the picture, then we let go. So that during this time, I really like to encourage a development, a really working with right effort in this way, seeing that it's not me that needs to practice right effort, but learning to trust the power of wisdom, power of awareness. When there is vijja, when there is that true knowing, then you know the heart knows how to respond. So that then it naturally moves towards bringing the wholesome into being, moving towards gentleness and respectfulness, moving towards focus and concentration, towards steadiness and stability. It's not something that I have to do. Even though from the outside you can say, you know, using conventional speech, we can say, I am doing that, you know, I am concentrating, or I am focusing the attention, I am cultivating kindness. On a conventional level, that's true. But the more that the heart is free from buying into that as a solid reality, and is just learning to trust the power of wisdom and awareness, and then we see that it does itself. Just like the body breathes on its own. You don't have to breathe. The eye does not, the ego does not have to involve itself in the respiration process. The body breathes on its own. And you might have noticed how when we're trying to be practicing mindfulness of breathing, and this is my experience in the first few weeks or months of trying to follow the meditation instruction when I was in Thailand many years ago, I remember distinctly having this feeling, do I do this all day long? This is such a chore. Breathing in, breathing out, breathing in. I can't have been doing this all, you know. I'm 21 years old. I can't have been doing this all this time. I mean, this is exhausting. It's just because it's such a chore for me to be breathing. Do you get what I mean? And so there's a strange feeling. You can't manage to do this all day long. I've got to have a break. And then you notice when you're distracted and the mind is wandering off into some fantasy or sort of drifting off into the past, or then the breath becomes easy and natural. Then suddenly, oh, back to the breath, quick. Yeah, I've often told the story about many years ago we were We're having a retreat at Chidhurst Monastery. This was way back when, before we'd even refurbished the shrine room. So we only had the living room at the front of the house, and it was the whole community of about 25 people squished into a room about a quarter or maybe a fifth the size of this. So we were all packed in pretty tight. And there was this, one of the Anagarikas was sitting right in front of me, you know, about 2 feet away. And he was a very good meditator. And he had a pretty firm concentration, but he was definitely one of these conscious breathers. And so his breath was so loud. I'm not kidding. It was just like that. But I actually gave up trying to concentrate on my breath, and I concentrated on his breath instead, because his was much louder than mine was. And then when he got distracted, then his breath would go very, very quiet. And it would sort of calm down and go very, very still. And then I could almost, I mean, I can't read people's minds, but it was almost like, oh my goodness, I've lost my concentration. Quick, back to the breath. And he goes, as he was reestablishing his focus. So me breathing is suffering. So it's exactly the same way. That we don't have to be me concentrating, me developing insight, me practicing loving kindness. The more that I get out the way, then the more perfectly and fluidly it happens. So certainly in this early part of the retreat, you can't make it. You can't have me deciding that I'm not going to be there. But a lot of it is just noticing that quality of when what it's like when the heart is really entangled in that, the me, I, me, my, the me doing, me getting rid of. Just to let that be full and conscious awareness of that, fully knowing what that feels like, and just contacting that quality of, this is miserable. This is a really unpleasant. And then just trusting the power of of wisdom to just catalyze the letting go. The intuitive wisdom, the natural wisdom of our own heart, then triggers that releasing and relaxing. I don't have to do it. You don't have to do it. You know, the heart does it on its own. Just like the body breathes on its own. The heart lets go on its own. Is inclining towards focus and clarity on its own. Maybe a last theme to outline this evening that I feel is always useful to be reflecting on and establishing early on in a retreat is just the whole quality of listening to our thoughts. And in a way it's helping to establish this clear awareness and a kindness towards all things. That we take our thoughts so personally. What goes through our minds, we take it so seriously and so personally, and we tend to believe everything that we think, which is a very bizarre thing to do. Maybe that has never occurred to you. But why should something be true just because we think it? Really, I mean, cause if you notice, we actually think a lot of contradictory thoughts, and what you were thinking, you know, last week or this morning or even 5 minutes ago could be the opposite of what we're thinking now. So how can both be true, right? So just to develop the attitude of listening, you know, attending to our thoughts, having a sort of loving appreciation and acceptance of our thoughts, but to not feel that we have to believe them. And just using a simple phrase like, just because I think it doesn't mean it's true. I saw a bumper sticker in Mendocino recently. Actually, it said, just because you think it doesn't mean it's true. They didn't quite have the sort of evolved, you know, second stage of it. Just because I think it doesn't mean it's true. But It's a simple aphorism, it's a simple standard, but it's an amazingly powerful tool to use. You know, it's a really wonderful lens to see things through. To use a simple reflection, a way of receiving and attending to our thoughts, to listen to them. You know, all the different identities, the different characters that we experience, all the various members of the inner committee, different characters gathered around our internal table, you know, the you know, the serious meditator, the, you know, the whining complainer, the merciless tyrant, the reasonable intellectual, the sensitive emotional type. You know, we all have our own, you know, array of dramatis personae, the different characters gathered around the table. And just learning to listen to all the different voices. You know, the complaining three-year-old, but I want it, it's not fair, you can't make me. I'm going to hold my breath till you give me what I want. Well, thank you for sharing. You know, these are natural enough voices. What I think, if you ask me what I think is, now let's be reasonable. Why don't we all, we listen, we attend, and these are all rightful members of the inner committee. They all have their place, they all have their right to be. The sweet three-year-old, the ranting three-year-old, the composed intellectual, the deeply spiritual, the emotional, the artist. Everybody belongs around the table. And the trick is to give the chair to wisdom and mindfulness, satipanya. If you do so, then we find, just like being any kind of committee meeting, we listen, we attend, we take it all in, we respect the different voices that are there, but we don't have to hand over the power to the ranting tyrant or the cynical critic or the grumpy three-year-old. We can listen, we can attend, we can respect. We don't have to hand over the authority to the more sort of erratic and chaotic, alienated mind states. But we listen, we attend, take it all in. And one of the simple kinds of practice that Ajahn Chah used to encourage, which also is a very a fundamental way of developing insight meditation. And we think of, say, developing vipassana, insight, by reflections on impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and selflessness, not self. And that can seem like quite a sort of formulaic way of working with it, or when the mind needs to be sort of deeply concentrated. But one of the most direct and effective ways of developing that insight into impermanence, the anicca sanya, the insight, and he used to use the translation uncertainty more than impermanence for anicca, because when we say impermanent, it has a sort of abstracted way. It's like describing sort of physical qualities or the physics of experience, that yes, everything is changing, and it kind of objectifies it. But if you look at the subjective side of it, how it's felt, how do we feel that quality of instability or change, that the way we feel that, the way that's known on the subject side, the felt side, is that of uncertainty. We don't know what's going to happen next. We don't know what things are. So he used to emphasize that quality of uncertainty as a reflection on anicca. And this is a simple but very effective kind of practice that I would like to encourage, is regardless of what we think, whether it's reasonable, whether it's wise and beautiful, whether it's kind and gentle and noble, or whether it's chaotic and peculiar, whether it's rational and sensible and logical, tyrannical, whatever it might be, just to as we notice what the train of thought is, whether we're sitting here in the hall or walking up and down or eating our meals or drinking a cup of tea or lying down to rest, whatever the mind says, whatever train of thought comes up, just to ask the question, is that so? I'm really a useless meditator. I'm not really cut out for this. Is that so? I think I'm really getting places. This is really going to be a great retreat. This is so good. Is that so? Yeah. I really think I've got it together with my yoga practice and my knee is, it's really going to be good this day. It's really feeling good. I think this is going to be great. Is that so? This is a disaster. Everything aches. I can't stand it. I hate these people. I hate Buddhism. I hate my mind. I hate my body. I hate everything. It's all wrong. Oh, is that so? If I could even just have some kind of an extreme state, just even everything is just so mediocre. I'm just so ordinary. I can't even get a kind of a decent rant going. I'm just so normal. Couldn't I just be a little bit extreme? You know, I'm just so utterly average. Is that so? Whatever it might be, beautiful, ugly, or average, mediocre, nondescript, just to meet it with that recognition of uncertainty. Is that so? Is this judgment of the way things are all and everything? Is it covering the whole picture? Is it the whole story? So just this simple way of assessing, receiving, acknowledging what we're experiencing. Is that so? Then we awaken that intuition in the heart that this judgment cannot be the whole story. It can't be. And we know that. In our heart of hearts, we know that. So this simple kind of reflection is arousing that intuition, bringing that intuition into being, reminding us that this judgment of success or failure or beauty or ugliness, rightness, wrongness, whatever it might be, it can't be the whole story. There's more to it than this. And it opens the heart to that, the Dhamma of it. So I would encourage, as we listen and experience the flow of different perceptions, delights, disasters, mediocrities, passing through our mind, judgments, criticisms, praises, just to develop this reflection on uncertainty. Is that so? Really? You can phrase it in your, you can kind of get creative and phrase it in your own way, but some way of working that perception, cultivating the sense of spaciousness around our judgments, rather than just blindly believing in something, as we tend to do. Is that so? Really? And then when we really apply that reflection, not just sort of repeating it like a sort of mindless mantra, like, is that so, is that so, is that so, is that so? But genuinely asking that question, is that so? Really? Or another one that Ajahn Chah used to recommend, which is a little bit more aggressive, which is liar. This is really great, liar. I can't stand this anymore, liar. I've had enough, this is it, I'm heading out of here. This is too much. Liar. So you can get, you know, you can get creative and work it your own way. But also the point being that when we apply that, rather than just repeating the words, take them a moment to reflect, what's the effect of applying that? When we apply that view of things, when we recognize, we ask, is that so? Is that really the whole story? Is that a fact? Then recognize, notice what happens in the heart when we apply that. Because there's this, at least what I experience is this, every time is a sense of, oh, yeah. And there's a way, and suddenly the world gets a little bit more spacious. We breathe a little bit more freely. There's that greater degree of of clarity, ease and contentment. So these are a few themes to ponder this evening. Please take what is useful, and what is not, then leave aside. Anyway.